On this special episode of the Traversing Stars podcast, we have returning champion William Sadler. We discuss his upcoming movie, Salem's Lot, and his career as a music performer. Now join me as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Mr. Sadler. Thank you so much for coming back to the Traversing the Stars podcast. You're one of my favorite actors to talk with.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's 100% my pleasure. So, as I'm doing some research about you, I always go through IDM Pro to find out about the actor. Have you done a lot of horror movies? Last time you were here, we talked about The Unholy. Right. So do you have a particular affinity for horror movies or acting in horror movies? And what draws you to the genre?
I don't know. Horror movies are fun. They're always fun. I mean, they're people in the most extreme situations. Like in The Mist, you know, you're all locked in a grocery store with monsters outside, or there's something very basic about, you know, I think it's in everyone's childhood, the creature in the closet or under the bed, or you know, and it's fun to they're fun to act in. I treat them exactly the way I would treat just about any acting challenge, because I'm of the opinion that if I can get people to believe the character, I mean, that's really the only part that I have control over. But if I can get people to believe just a little bit in my character and what he's going through, what he's actually feeling and doing, then they will come along for the ride. You know, then you can take them to, you know, another galaxy. You can pretend that there are creatures outside the grocery store that are trying to eat us. All of that stuff is hard to buy unless there's at least something at the center of the story that the audience looks at and says, oh no, that's true. You know, that feels real. And I guess I sort of feel like that's my job.
What I find that's kind of fun is that having spoken to you, and I follow you on social media, you're one of the nicest guys, you know, it doesn't seem fake with you. You seem like one of the nicest guys there is. So when you play villains, it's kind of like, where the hell is that coming from? Like, how is it someone looks at you and goes, that's an awesome villain? When I think to myself, when I look at you, go, he's too nice to be a villain.
I know. No, that just sort of happened to me with when I got to Los Angeles, when I started doing movies. I think the very first big movie I did was Project X, where I was the scientist who killed all the chimps, you know, radiate, teach them to fly, and then put them in flight simulators and then radiate them so that they die. I was like, I don't know. It's good to put good actors in those kind of roles, because then the threat to the hero feels real. It's the reason, I think, why you see, you know, like Anthony Hopkins, you know, in Silence of the Lambs. The only reason you really, you know, you're scared shitless about what's going to happen to Clarice is because he's so good and so believable. And so I think that's my job. You can't have a good James Bond unless you've got a really good Dr. No.
You know what I mean? 100%. I mean,
what's the big deal? The villains have got to be a real sinister threat if the hero is going to be a hero of any, you know, of any kind. So,
yeah, I agree 100%. Yeah. Like Heath Ledger.
I don't know why I get to play bad guys. But I take it as a compliment. So
now, I feel like sometimes when you look at, even though they're not the be-all and all, like award shows, they're talking about like actors. Usually it's the drama that gets the respect. Comedies and horror tend not to be viewed at that level. Do you think they're underappreciated, or the acting involved necessary to be in these movies are underappreciated?
Yeah, I do. I think they should be looked at in the same, You know, with, I think they should be given the same weight. If you think, you know, it's wonderful to, you know, it, the acting is so wonderful in these dramas, try doing a comedy, you know? Act, it's like, who, I forget who said it, dying's not hard. Acting, a comedy is hard, you know? Make, pull off a really funny character or funny scenes. That's, it's totally underappreciated. The chops involved, the people that can do that, you know?
And, you know, and I agree. I think, because I think with the difference between horror and, let's say, a drama, a lot of these dramas are, I'm not saying not real world, but they deal with actual regular emotion that we all can kind of empathize with because we've been in those situations. Horror is something different. It's the same with comedy. You're trying to get people to buy into something that's totally outside the realm of our experience and believe it 100% as being real and scary, even though we're not there. I mean, that's a far harder thing to pull off as an actor.
I think so. I think so. And like I said, I don't approach them differently, really. I did a lot of theater before I started doing films, I don't approach them. I don't really approach them differently. They should be treated the same. Even though where we're taking the audience is different, it's the job is still to get them to buy into it so that you can take them there. And in some ways, it's harder to get them to buy into. he's becoming a vampire.
No, I completely agree with you. When you're on the set of horror movies, and like I said, you've had such a tremendously long career. Does it sometimes, I'm not going to say any specific movie, so you don't have to name names or anything like that. Does it feel like sometimes those involved are not approaching it the same way as they would another movie? I know, like I said, you do. Do you feel like sometimes the others involved may not? And some movies don't say anything specific.
I don't think so. I'm not that I'm aware of. I think people that make horror movies, like the Mist, for example, Frank Darabont bought into it completely. You know, everyone in the cast, you give it 110% because that's the job, you know, and that's I think the difference between a well done horror film, and it at least has a chance to move people to engage the audience and become, you know, all that it can be. If you don't, you know, we've all watched films where there's something about, and Hollywood does this all the time, where they'll cast people based on their popularity. You know, based on how many followers they have on Twitter or something, rather than the acting chops, their actual acting skills, and we've all watched movies where they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the film, and there's something right at the center of the scene that you're not quite buying. You know, you're like, you sit there going, I don't know why don't I care about these people?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, which is, you know, it's a common mistake. It's very easy. I shouldn't say it's easy, but you know, you put together the elements. This is a huge director, and this is an enormous budget, and that's a great set. And we're paying millions and millions of dollars for this cast. It's like if you assemble the pieces, there's still no guarantee. There's no guarantee at all that the finished product is going to move anyone, is going to have the chemistry required to capture people's imagination and you know, make them go and see it again and again. Anyway, that's That's yeah. my opinion, and I'm sticking to it.
No, I agree with you 100%. I mean, once again, I'm not going to name names of anyone, just in case I ever talk to those people. But
right.
but every so often, you know, I know several major movies, and you know, beautiful movies to look at,
yeah.
cinema. But right at the heart, they chose an actor, and you're just like, you know, the problem
right.
is I can tell that he is performing the role. But while other actors, like when you're in a role, it feels like you're in the role. Like I don't think about you as an acting. Like when you played the Reaper in Bill and Ted Bone Insurance, I just buy the character. I just accept it because I buy right. into you. But sometimes you watch a movie, you're like, I can tell he's an actor in a movie.
I think that's, well, that's another way of saying exactly the what we're talking about. That if you can believe that character and forget for a minute that you're watching, you know, an actor and the cameras and the script and all the rest of the fake stuff. If you can buy into it a little bit, we can take you anywhere, you know, we can make you laugh. We can break your heart. We can,
yeah.
But if you don't buy into it, if there's something in the on the screen that's making you go, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know, it's a good movie. It's a good movie. You know, if something, and you can, and often you can't quite put your finger on what it is that's the matter.
Yeah.
That, you know, what's why am I not digging this? And that's usually has to do with the acting, you know.
Now, when you're in a movie, right? Because, like I said, you've been in so many. I'm sure you've been in some movies. Once again, you don't have to say which ones, where you played against an actor that you could tell isn't selling it. Does it mm-hmm. make it hard for you to buy into your character when you're playing against someone who doesn't look like they bought into theirs?
Yeah, it does. And conversely, if you're doing a scene like with James Spader in The Blacklist, or I did a film with Karen Allen, who's a terrific actress. If you're doing a scene opposite someone who's, you know, or Shawshank opposite, you know, Morgan Freeman, it's the thing just lifts off the page. There's no, it's like a mm-hmm. tennis match between two people who can really play. And if you're working with someone who's not, you know, not giving you what you not very good or struggling with it. You still have to find a way in. You still have to find a way to make what your engagement with this person believable. So it's just more challenging. Yeah, you do. Okay, well, of course. You work with people of all different, you know, you work with someone on a TV show who's been on the show for 150 years and they just could, they're calling it in,
yeah.
you know, they're just can't be bothered to get it up anymore. and you somehow have to keep your own fire burning. You know, don't let them drag you into that vortex of I don't really want to be here. I'm already shopping for shoes somewhere else. You know, look at the time. So. Yeah.
You are such a great actor, and I'm not just throwing shit. You are a fantastic actor, and when you play a villain, Die Hard 2, some other ones as well. Do you find that you do such a good job that people are actually afraid of you on set a little bit? Like, does it carry the fear of you as an actor, the character in the movie? Does it kind of carry over off set a little bit, where people are like, "Oh shit, it's a little scared to approach you"?
I think when I first meet people on the set, they're sometimes intimidated. Maybe because I've been in a lot of stuff, and maybe because they, you know, they've seen me play such, you know, hard asses. But part of my job too is to let them know, is to, you know, get on the same page with them. They mustn't be afraid to throw stuff at me, or, you know, we have to engage with one another. So we have to get, we have to find a way to get past that quickly. You know, off the set, people used to, there were a lot of people who were surprised that I'm a nice person. If all you've ever seen is the guy from Die Hard 2 or something, or Hard to Kill, you know, they're like, they I don't know what they expect, but they're often surprised.
Yeah, I mean, lucky to talk to you three times. It's my third time talking to you, and I will say the first time I spoke to you, I was kind of expecting kind of this tough guy to be like, oh man, this is gonna be a rough interview. Be trying to get on my game because this guy is gonna chew me up if I'm not careful. You're like the nicest guy I've ever met. So, like, you know, it's just funny watching Die Hard 2 thinking, when you're like a villain or in a whole like that, I'm watching him like, he's not scary. He's a real nice guy.
Sorry. That's the gig. That's the job, and you have to, you know, you have to, you get a script, you have to identify not just who this guy is and what he, you know, what he does and what he wants and his relationship to all these other people. You also have to find out what's his job in the film. In the big story arc, is he the one that at the end you're surprised to find out that he's a nice guy, you know? So in which case you want to lean into what a badass he is, you know. You have to gauge what it is that the film wants. From this character, what's this character's function in the story? You know, is he the red herring, or is he the nice guy who at the end I auditioned for and then turned down when I got the job, the murderer in The Bone Collector.
Oh wow.
It's another loving, sweet guy. And the trick with him would have been, you see him, you meet that character a couple of times in the movie before you find out that who he is, that he cuts people up and he's, you know, he's this monster. And the trick with me would have been, I ended up turning the film down, but it would have been to throw the audience off, make him so likable that you'd never expect that was going to come from him, which is kind of hard because I have people come to movies with a backlog of, oh no, he was the guy in this and he was the, you know what I mean? The second you would have seen me deliver pizza in the beginning of the movie, that it would be hard for people not to go, dude, did you see who's delivering the pizza? You know what I mean? But that's what I mean though. You not only have to figure out what it is you're going to do with, you know, the key character you're going to create. Well, I could, like the Grim Reaper, he's terrifying in the beginning. The first time you meet him in Bogus Journey, he's this figure that he should scare the crap out of you. And he does, and he scares the crap out of them until they engage him in the games, at which point he becomes this petulant, spoiled, sore loser, weasel, you know, trying to weasel out of it. And all of a sudden, all of these other colors start coming up and he's not so dangerous. He's just a dope, like, you know, and he's got this really nice arc throughout the movie, until finally he wants to be a part of the band. He wants to be, you know, So that's what I do with. That was a long-winded way to say that's what I do when I see a script.
No, it was a great answer.
Thank you.
So, you're going to be in the upcoming Salem's Lot movie, right?
Now,
when you chose Salem's Lot, first, why did you choose that film? And second, is that the first movie you've been in that's had previous versions?
Interesting. Yeah, I think it is the first movie I've been in that had previous versions. I said yes to the project because I love Stephen King. I think it was, that would be my fourth Stephen King movie.
Oh wow.
And they're phenomenal. They're great fun to work with. He's a fantastic writer. He creates characters that are that have wonderful colors and human foibles and, you know, cowardice when you need a hero and hero when you need cowardice. And they're really fun. And I was sort of also because I'd been in three other Stephen King movies, I was sort of the, they call it an Easter egg.
Yeah.
My character was sort of an Easter egg. The fact that I was in it because I was, he was in The Mist and he was in The Green Mile and he was in Shawshank. And there were little nods to those lots of other Stephen King movies throughout. But it was great, you know, fantastic cast and director. I thought it was, I thought it had a chance to be a really terrific film. I liked the David Sewell one from years ago. Maybe it was just time to, you know, try it again.
All right. So when you're playing in a movie like Salem's Lot, and obviously, yes. Like, so this movie has been, actually it's had two versions. There's a miniseries that came out a couple of years ago, and then there's another one from the 1979. So obviously it's been played before, the part's been played before. How do you approach a character that you know has prior versions? Do you try to block it out completely? Do you look at it for inspiration?
That's a tough one. I mean, if you were cast as Stanley Kowalski in Streetcar, you can't ignore the fact, you know, that Brando did it before. It's like you have a real hurdle to get over. But in this case, because I didn't pay too much attention to what had been done before. I thought maybe it would be better if we created our own world with our own relationships and our own, you know, the fabric of this universe is just this universe. And don't pay too much attention to who's played what or how they did it. I don't usually find it helpful to, because I can get intimidated if it's been played by someone wonderful. I can say, oh crap, now what do I do? He did all the good stuff.
Do you find it riskier to play a part that's been done before, or is there a confidence knowing the movie itself, at least the plot, has been embraced by audiences once before?
I think in this particular case, I think the story is so strong. It's a great Stephen King novel, and I think the elements of the story are so compelling, are so strong that you have to play them. Pay attention to the actions, you know, what happens to your people, to these people this time, and it'll carry you through. It's not to compare it to Shakespeare or anything, but Hamlet's been done and done and done and done. you know, for hundreds of years, you have to tend your own fire. You have to find your own voice in these characters. And you know, it's fun to look at what other people have done with, but at the end of the day, you have, the more complete and compelling you can make your people, the better story you're going to tell.
So, listen, when you're playing the character that's been done, are you able to make to hear your own voice in the character? Like, or like, do you, like I said, so you don't ever and you never go back to take a look?
You mean,
when you're playing a character, like I said, that that has, you said, like I said, has the prior movies.
Oh, that's been done before.
Right. Are you able to make sure that you can hear your own voice in the character, and do you avoid going back at all? Because I know you said it before, so it's in your memory.
Yeah, I. Yeah, I play. I. It's in your memory, but it's. But when they say action, you're pretty specifically focused on this thing, this time, this place. I don't. I try not to let the past performances confuse me, or inform what I'm doing, because you can't be sure that anybody else has seen any. I mean. You know, this is a new audience, new generation, new people. New people are going to see this who have never seen it before. And yours is going to be the one that they measure, you know. It's the only one that matters. It's the only thing you have any control over as an actor is what happens between when they say action and when they say cut. You know, that 48 seconds or whatever it is, 3 minutes, it's really the only thing you're responsible for, but it's also the only thing you have a lot of control over.
Now, having been an actor in so many horror films and having your reputation in some of these movies, are you able to you lean on that reputation when you do the performance? That, you know, you can either back off because people are going to look and go, he is the horror, he's scary, because I've seen him in scary stuff before. Are you able to, or do you kind of go, you don't want to rely on, you know, what people may come in looking.
Well, sometimes it's good to lean on that stuff. You can, you know, because people have them, you know, they have a history with my characters. They're, you know, they've seen me do things before, and you carry that stuff with you to the next movie that you see them in. So it's, and that can work to your advantage. You don't have to, you know, I don't have to do very much at all to get people to think, he could kill you and then sit on your chest and eat a sandwich. It's because they have a history with that, with the actor, with those other roles, and you do bring that. So it'd be like, if you could cast, you know, James Gandolfini in something today as, let's say a hard ass cop.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have to do much to get the audience to carry over the Sopranos character to, you know, I mean, Al Pacino does this a lot, you know, if you've seen him do it enough, you can just nod to it and the audience goes, oh shit.
it's an aid more than it's baggage, you would say?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
So go ahead, sorry.
No, I was gonna say it's only baggage if you're trying, if like I did a show called Wonderfalls, where I had to prove to the casting people and the directors on that I could be funny, because I had played all of these heavy killer monster characters. You know, then you have to prove to people that you can be play a dad, or be a, you know, play a kindergarten teacher, or, you know, or be funny. You've always got to show people.
At any point in your career, like I said, your career has been, obviously you've been extremely successful, you had such a long career, Was there ever a point that you got afraid of typecasting, that it could happen to you?
I was worried at first when I first got to Los Angeles, and it was the heavy in Project X, and then the heavy, I was the heavy in The Hot Spot, and Hard to Kill, and Die Hard 2. And I'm thinking, wow, this is, you know, Hollywood is really good at slamming you into a little cubbyhole and saying, well, he's good at that. I don't want to see him do Shakespeare. I don't want to see him do anything else. And I was worried about it until Bill and Ted came along, and then and then I was successfully funny in a movie, and that kind of, I don't know, that just threw a wrench into the bad guys. Then it was like, well, how can we take him seriously as a bad guy if he's we've seen him be so goofy. No, I don't worry about it anymore.
So Salem's Lot was directed by Gary Doberman, I believe is how you pronounce the last name, who has also has a wonderful horror pedigree for movies like The Nun. So what kind of insights to the genre of horror did he bring, and how did he, was he to work with, and did he have insights into how you could perform in the horror movie that might have been different than another director who didn't have the pedigree?
Gary was great to work with, but he did the thing that I like the most with directors, which was first they see what they trust the actor that they cast, and they first take a good look at what I think of the character, where I think he should go, and then tweak, you know, make the character a little funnier, or make this moment lighter, or make this. He's a terrific director in that regard, and in that you feel like you come away feeling very confident about what you're doing, and if he needs to nudge it one way or the other, nudge. You know, he does it in that great way. It's like you finish the scene and he leans over and says, he's lying to you. Do it again. And we go again with that note, you know. Yeah. And it's almost as if you drop a little bit of ink in the water and it just goes everywhere, and it colors the whole scene without changing, you know, it doesn't change the basic shape of the scene, but it adds a color that wasn't there before. And anyway, I enjoyed working with him. I think that, he approached it. He approached it with his sensibility and his, you know, his compass. And I agree. Sometimes I'll sit there and think, why is the director going in that direction? But with him, I knew exactly where he was going. We were sort of on the same wavelength right along.
Yeah. So Salem's Lot comes out, is it later? When is it supposed to come out? Do you know?
I don't know.
No, fair enough. One other thing I found was fascinating about you is that you actually have a music career. You're a music performer when you're not acting.
Yeah. I've played guitar and ukulele and banjo and mandolins all my life, since I was a little kid on the farm. And I've written songs all my life too. But when the pandemic hit and all of the industry was just put on hold, and everybody was stuck in their homes, I started to focus on my songs, and I started to write new ones as well, and share them around. And I ended up, I have a kind of a producer. I have a sound engineer who works with me. In fact, we were both just given Emmys for, not the actual Emmy. Stephen Colbert got the actual Emmy. We got the hey, Emmy committee, you should give those guys some kind of a plaque too. So me and Matthew Kulowitz, my sound engineer, both got this Emmy. We were Emmy adjacent, I guess, for the Cartoon President show. But anyway, he's been helping me, and I have another friend named Steve Kirkman who's been helping me. And before I knew it, I had a dozen or so songs. I started sharing them. I started making these things called the kitchen tapes, where I would sit in my kitchen and play them and sing them and tell stories about movies. And you can go on YouTube and find the kitchen tapes. And I think what I'm going to do with, because I don't know how you release a song or an album these days, but I think what I'm going to do now is we're getting ready to go into a studio at Master Disc in Peekskill, New York. And with a little group, and perform these and tape them and put those out.
Oh, very like cool.
With better sound and better editing and, also probably on the kitchen tapes. And I think that's how they're going to be released. And then maybe out to a streaming service or something so people can, or maybe I'll have vinyl printed up. I can't believe they still do vinyl. Everything was vinyl when I was for half of my life. But I guess people do vinyl. And, maybe I'll have a bunch of those printed up and then sell them through a website or something. And I'm thinking of having the proceeds go to Doctors Without Borders or something.
Oh, wow.
Not make it a, I'm not looking to have a second career as a singer songwriter, but I think the songs are fun and worthwhile. And, I have this nightmare in the back of my head of like William Shatner smoking a cigarette and doing Rocket Man.
Oh, Rocket Man, yeah.
It isn't as great as that was. It isn't that. Okay, these are authentic songs that I actually wrote, and I hope people like them. So
back when you were a kid, you were in a band called The Night Riders.
Yeah.
Is the music you're writing now in the similar genre as you did when you were in The Night Riders?
No, when I was in The Night Riders, we just did covers of Stone songs and The Birds. And, we did Gloria. G-L-O-R-I-A, glow, anything with three chords, we just nailed. We had long hair and we had tight pants, and we actually rehearsed in a garage, in my garage in Buffalo. And we won the Battle of the Bands. It was, under my thumb, a girl who once put me down. The band was it was great fun. It was great fun, and we were kind of popular in high school. We played dances around high school and fire halls and things like that. We won the Battle of the Bands.
That's so cool.
But that was 1965, 66, 67, And I was in a folk group before that. And then, and then I was in the Kegs, and then I was in the Night Riders. And then I discovered acting. But, and one of the reasons that the band, that the band, I sort of set the band aside, was I went off, I discovered acting, and there was a lot to learn there. But also, I didn't just want to do covers. I didn't want to. The really exciting part would be to write something, create the harmonies, create the song, and put that out there. You know, I mean, as fun as it is to do, but what was it, the Standells who did down by the river, down on the banks of the river, Charles, bum, bum, dum, dum, dum. That's where you'll find me, along with lovers, muggers, and thieves. Bum, 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 bum. Love that dirty water. Yeah, we killed that song. And GLOR and Gloria and Louis Louis. Like I said, three chords. They're all three chords. But we realized them. So, and the other one we did was 96 tier. That's like two chords. Boom. I'm gonna cry 96 tears. Cry, 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 cry. Anyways, there you go. That's my life in a nutshell.
So when you're now when you're writing your music, where are, as that question may be, like, where is the music coming from? Are you thinking of a particular genre, or is the words coming to you and then you built it around a genre, followed genre of music or a sound around it?
They're from various, but I guess a lot of it may sound kind of like urban folk, singer-songwriter stuff, you know, kind of early Paul Simon or James Taylor, or, you know, in that world. Some of them are, I have a couple of them that are like old rockabilly. I don't know, one called 29 Cups of Coffee that kicks ass, but it deliberately sounds like an old Elvis number, you know, very retro. And yeah, it's whatever suits the story of the song. If, you know, and some of them are kind of sweet romantic things. Some of them are down, I guess a lot of them kind of live in the Randy Newman, Leon Redbone, you know, there a lot of old school, I draw from a lot of old school influences for these things. A lot of them are funny, because I get, you know, I'll get some silly idea in my head and write the song down that road. So I'm excited to see how people react to this, if they're, you know, if I've had good responses among the few people that have listened to them so far, but I sort of can't wait to. I'll let you know when it's when we're about to break loose.
That'd be awesome.
And yeah. I would be happy to.
So, have you performed in front of an audience yet? The new stuff, not obviously when you're being obviously you did that, but now have you performed the new music in front of an audience?
I have. I used to do before the pandemic. Anyway, I was getting up at the, I was singing at the Town Crier Cafe in Beacon, New York. They have a big stage, and he kept inviting me back to do, you know, bigger and bigger shows of my songs, just me and a guitar. And I'm a okay guitar player, but it's really more fun if I get a couple guys behind me, you know, to fill out the sound. And then the pandemic hit and it kind of shot that in the head. So I'm looking forward to doing these videos of in a studio where the sound is good, you know, where we have complete control over the miking and the sound and so on. I think that'll be cool.
So obviously as an actor, you're used to performing in front of people. Did you find, because the music is yours and the lyrics are yours, do you feel more exposed performing your music or when you're acting?
When I'm doing the music.
Doing the music?
Yeah. Well, it's, I have a lot of confidence as an actor. You can throw almost anything at me and I'm pretty sure I can, you know, I can find my way through it. I have less experience getting up and singing my own songs. And trusting that people will enjoy them and the stories that the songs tell will be interesting. But it's just practice. I'm getting better and better at that all the time. But yeah, you feel much more exposed when it's, you know, they don't know you as a singer. They've never heard these songs before. You're a pretty good guitar player, but you know, it's not Dave Mason, or John Mayer. So I can't, you know what I mean? I can't lean back on those things, but the package that you get with me, it has its own flavor.
Once again, as we talked earlier, as an actor, the idea of phoning things in or finding your mood for a particular character or your place. When you're singing a song, once again, it's your lyrics, but you don't always necessarily are in that headspace at that moment when you're singing the song. Is your acting then taken over when you're performing?
Yes. I think so.
Yeah.
I find that when I write songs, I imagine a character saying these things to his girlfriend or to the world, and I also find myself falling into the characters that are talking, you know. So
when can our listeners expect to maybe hear some of your music?
Hear some of the exciting music that we're creating. I would think in a month or so they're mastering the recordings now, and we're working out the details of these videos that we're going to make. I guess there's something along the lines of the Tiny Desk series that NPR does, you know. They may feel a bit like that, although it's a nicer studio. It'll be good.
When they're ready to be released, please let me know. We'll add it to the video, yeah, and the audio, so people will know where to find it. So, Mr. Sadler, absolute pleasure to talk with you. I know you're busy, so I'll make sure I let you go. But again, third time the charm, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Take care. You too.